innocent child. That cruel dictator, that deviant, instead of taking care of the empire and the people, persecuted and tortured a child. For that, he won't escape vengeance.
I very much approve, Ardal Abdai declared.
I do too, grated Wakim de Vet.
Splendid, gushed the Count of Broina. For outraging other men's wives, the tyrant and degenerate will receive his just deserts. Splendid.
One thing, Leuven drawled out his syllables. In order to establish trust, Count Stefan, please reveal to us Lord Vilgefortz's current place of abode.
Gentlemen, I'm forbidden.
It will be a guarantee,
a safeguard of your sincerity and devotion to the cause.
Don't be afraid of betrayal, Stefan, added Epdai. None of those present here will betray us. It's a paradox. Under other conditions, perhaps among us, there'd be one who would buy his life by betraying the others. But all of us know only too well that we don't buy anything with perfidy. Emir Var Emris doesn't forgive. He is incapable of forgiving. He has a lump of ice in place of his heart, which is why he must die.
Stefan Skellen didn't hesitate for long.
Very well, he said. Let it be a safeguard of my sincerity. Vilgefortz is hiding in...
The Witcher, sitting at the openings of the trumpets, clenched his fists so hard they hurt. He pricked up his ears and racked his memory. The Witcher's doubts regarding Fringilla's amulet were misplaced and were dispelled in a flash. When he entered the large cavern and approached the stone bridge above the black chasm, the medallion jerked and fluttered on his neck, now not like a sparrow, but like a large, strong bird, a rook, for example. Geralt froze. The amulet calmed down. He didn't make the smallest movement in order that not a single rustle or even loud breath would confuse his ears. He waited. He knew that on the other side of the chasm, beyond the bridge, was whatever was lurking in the darkness. He couldn't rule out that something might also be hiding behind his back, and that the bridge was meant to be a trap. He had no intention of being caught in it. He waited until something happened.
"Greetings, Witcher," he heard. "We've been waiting here for you."
The voice emerging from the gloom sounded strange. But Geralt had heard voices like that before, and he knew them. The voices of creatures not accustomed to communicating using speech. Able to use the apparatus of the lungs, diaphragm, windpipe and voice box, these creatures weren't in complete control of their articulatory apparatus, even when the construction of their lips, palates and tongues were quite similar to those of humans. The words spoken by creatures like that, apart from their strange accent and intonation, were full of sounds unpleasant to the human ear, from hard and nastily barking to hissing and slimily soft.
"We've been waiting for you," repeated the voice. "We knew you'd come, lured by rumours, that you'd crawl in here under the ground. To stalk, pursue, torment and murder. You won't leave here now. You won't see the sun you've come to love so much again."
"Show yourself."
Something moved in the darkness on the far side of the bridge. In one place, the gloom seemed to thicken and assume a more or less human form. The creature, it seemed, never remained in the same position or place for a moment, but shifted with the help of swift, nervous, and shimmering movements. The Witcher had seen such creatures before.
"A Corrid," he stated coldly. "I might have expected somebody like you here."
It's a wonder I haven't happened upon you before.
Well.
Derision sounded in the restless creature's voice.
It's dark, but he recognized me. And do you recognize him? And him? And him?
Three more creatures emerged from the darkness as noiselessly as ghosts. One of them, lurking behind the corrid's back, was also humanoid in shape and general appearance, but was shorter, more hunched and more simian. Geralt knew it was a Kilmulis. The two other monsters, as he had rightly suspected, were skulking in front of the bridge, ready to cut off his retreat if he stepped onto it. The first, on the left, scrabbled its claws like a huge spider, stopped moving, and shuffled its numerous legs. It was a Prishkirnik. The last creature, roughly resembling a candelabra, seemed to slip straight out from the cracked slate wall. Geralt couldn't guess what it was. A monster like that didn't feature in any witcher tomes. "I don't want to fight," he said, counting a little on the fact that the creatures had begun by talking instead of simply leaping on his back from the darkness. "I don't want to pick a fight with you. But if it comes to it, I'll defend myself."
"We've taken that into account," hissed the Corred. "Which is why there are four of us. Which is why we lured you here. You've driven us to a dog's life, oh roguish witcher. The most beautiful holes in this part of the world. A wonderful place for wintering. We've been wintering here almost since the dawn of time. And now you've come here hunting, you good-for-nothing. Chasing us. Stalking us. Keeping us for money. We're putting an end to it, and to you too."
"Listen, Corrid,
be polite,"
the creature snapped.
"I can't stand boorishness."
"How should I address
Mr. Schweitzer?"
"And so, Mr. Schweitzer," continued Geralt, apparently obediently and meekly, "it's like this. I came here, I admit, as a witcher, with a witcher task. I suggest we pass over the matter. Something has occurred in these vaults, however, which has changed the situation diametrically. I've learned something extremely important to me, something that may change my entire life."
"And what results from that?"
"I must immediately get onto the surface." Geralt was a model of calm and patience. "I must immediately set off on a long journey without a moment's delay. A road which may turn out to be one from which I won't return. I doubt if I'll ever be back in these parts."
"You want to buy your life like that, witcher?"
hissed Mr. Schweitzer.
"Nothing doing. Your begging is in vain. We have you in our grasp, and we won't let you out of it. We will kill you, not just for our own sake, but for the sake of our other comrades. For our freedom and your freedom, so to speak."
"I won't just never return here," Geralt continued patiently. "But I shall cease my witcher activities. I shall never kill any of you again."
"You lie! You lie from fear!"
But Geralt wasn't to be interrupted this time either. "I must, as I've said, get out of here right away. So you have two alternatives to choose from. Firstly, you'll believe in my sincerity, and I'll leave you here. Or secondly,
I leave here over your dead bodies.
Or thirdly, the Corrid rasped, you'll be the dead body.
The witcher's sword rasped as he drew it from the scabbard on his back.
Not the only one, he said unemotionally. Certainly not the only one, Mr. Schweitzer.
The Corrid was silent for some time. The Kilmulis was rocking and rasping behind his back. The Prishgirnik was bending and straightening its limbs. The candelabra was changing its shape. Now it looked like a misshapen Christmas tree with two huge glowing eyes.
Give us some proof, the Corrid said at last, of your sincerity and goodwill.
What?
Your sword. You claim you'll give up being a witcher. A witcher is his sword. Throw it into the chasm. Or break it. Then we'll let you out.
For a moment, Geralt stood without moving. The water dripping from the walls and ceiling could be heard in the silence. Then, slowly, without hurrying, he jammed his sword vertically and deeply into a rocky cleft and broke the blade with a powerful blow of his boot. The blade shattered with a whine whose echo sounded in the caverns. Water dripped from the walls, dribbling down them like tears.
I can't believe it,
the Corrid said slowly.
I can't believe anyone would be that stupid.
They all fell on him, instantly, without any shouting, noises or commands. Mr. Schweitzer was the first to lope across the bridge, his claws extended and baring fangs that wouldn't have shamed a wolf. Geralt let him come closer, then twisted his hips and slashed, hacking through his throat and lower jaw. The next moment, he was on the bridge and cutting open the Kilmulis with a powerful blow. He crouched and fell to the ground just in time, and the attacking candelabra flew over his head, barely scratching his jacket with its talons. The witcher dodged away from the Prishgirnik, from its thin legs flashing like scythes. A blow from one of them hit him on the side of the head. Geralt danced, making a feint and encircling himself with a sweeping slash. The Prishgirnik leapt again but missed. It crashed against the barrier and smashed it, tumbling into the chasm with a hail of stones. Until that moment, it hadn't emitted the merest sound, but now it howled as it hurtled into the chasm. The howling gradually faded. They attacked him from two sides. From one, the candelabra, from the other, the Kilmulis, which, although wounded and gushing blood, had managed to stand up. The witcher jumped onto the balustrade of the bridge, felt shifting stones grinding against each other and the whole bridge shuddering. He balanced, slipped out of reach of the candelabra's clawed feet and found himself behind the Kilmulis's back. The Kilmulis didn't have a neck, so Geralt slashed it in the temple. But the monster's skull was like iron, so he had to hack it a second time. He lost too much time doing it. He was hit in the head. The pain exploded in his skull and eyes. He whirled around, defending himself with a parry, feeling blood pouring from under his hair, trying hard to understand what had happened. He dodged another blow of the claws and understood. The candelabra had changed shape. It was now attacking with its improbably extended legs. That had a flaw. Now its center of gravity and balance was disrupted. The witcher ducked under the legs, drawing closer. The candelabra, seeing what was afoot, fell on its back like a cat, sticking out its rear legs, which were just as taloned as its forelegs. Geralt jumped over it, slashing mid-leap. He felt the blade cut flesh. He hunched up, turned, and cut once more, dropping to his knee. The creature screamed and threw its head forward violently, savagely snapping its massive teeth just in front of the witcher's chest. Its huge eyes shone in the darkness. Geralt shoved it back with a powerful blow of the sword pommel and cut from close range, removing half its skull. Even without that half, the strange creature, which didn't feature in any witcher tomes, still snapped its teeth for a good few seconds. Then it died, with a terrible, almost human sigh. The corrid was twitching convulsively in a pool of blood. The witcher stood over it.
"I cannot believe," he said, "that someone could be so stupid as to be taken in by such a simple illusion as the one with the broken sword."
He wasn't certain if the corrid was conscious enough to understand, but actually, he didn't care.
"I warned you," he said,
wiping off the blood that was pouring down his cheek.
"I warned you I had to get out of here."
Mr. Schweitzer trembled violently, wheezed, whistled, and gnashed his teeth, then fell silent and stopped moving. Water dripped from the walls and ceiling.
"Are you satisfied, Regis?"
"I am now."
"In that case," the witcher stood. "Go on, run off and pack and be quick."
"It won't take me very long. Omnia mea mecum porto."
"What?"
"I have very little luggage."
"So much the better. Outside the town in half an hour."
"I'll be there."
He'd underestimated her. She caught him in the act. He only had himself to blame. Rather than rushing, he could have ridden around the back of the palace and left Roach in the larger stables there, the one for the errant knighthood, staff and servants, and where his company also kept their horses. He hadn't done that, but had used the ducal stables owing to haste and habit, and he might have guessed there would be somebody in the stable who would inform on him. She was walking from stall to stall, kicking the straw. She was wearing a short, lynx-skin coat, a white satin blouse, a black equestrian skirt and high boots. The horses snorted, sensing the anger emanating from her.
"Well, well,"
she said on seeing him, flexing the riding crop she was holding.
"We are bolting, without saying goodbye, for the letter which is probably lying on my table is no farewell, not after what we had. I imagine some extremely important arguments explain and justify your behaviour."
"They do. Sorry, Fringilla."
"Sorry, Fringilla," she repeated, sneering furiously. "How curt, how economical, how unpretentious, with such attention to style. The letter you left for me, I'm absolutely certain, is doubtless edited just as elegantly, without excess lavishness as regards ink."
"A must ride," he uttered. "You can guess why, and for whose sake. Please forgive me. I intended to flee stealthily and silently, because I didn't want you to try and come after me."
"Your fears were groundless," she drawled, bending the crop. "I wouldn't have gone after you, even if you'd asked me, grovelling at my feet. Oh, no, Witcher. Ride alone, die alone, freeze alone in the mountain passes. I have no obligations towards Ciri. And towards you, do you know how many have begged for what you had? And for what you're now contemptuously rejecting, tossing away?"
"I'll never forget you."
"Oh," she hissed, "you don't know how much I feel like making sure you really want. Even if not using magic, then using this whip."
"You won't do it."
"You're right. I won't. I wouldn't be able to. I shall behave as befits a scorned and spurned lover. Classically, I shall walk away with my head high, with dignity and pride, swallowing back the tears, then I'll howl into a pillow and then I'll bid another."
By the end, she was almost screaming. He said nothing. Neither did she.
"Geralt,"
she said finally, in quite a different voice.
"Stay with me. I think I love you,"
she said, seeing he was delaying his answer.
"Stay with me. I implore you. I've never asked anyone, nor thought I ever would. But I ask you."
"Fringilla," he answered after a while. "You're a woman a man can only dream about. My fault, my only fault, is that I don't have the nature of a dreamer."
You are,
she said a moment later, biting her lip.
Like an angler's hook, which once it's stuck in, can only be pulled out with blood and flesh. Well, I've only got myself to blame. I knew what I was doing, playing around with a dangerous toy. Luckily, I also know how to cope with the effects. In that respect, I have an advantage over the rest of the female species.
He didn't comment.
In any case, she added, a broken heart, although it hurts greatly, a lot more than a broken arm, heals much, much more quickly.
He didn't comment that time either. Fringilla contemplated the bruise on his cheek.
How was my amulet? Does it work well?
It's quite simply wonderful. Thank you. She nodded.
Were you riding too?
She asked in a completely different voice and tone.
What did you find out? You know where Vilgefort is hiding, don't you?
Yes. Don't ask me to tell you where that is. A worm.
I'll buy that information. Quid pro quo?
Oh, yes.
I have information, she repeated, that is valuable, and to you, quite simply invaluable. I'll sell it to you in exchange for...
For peace of mind, he finished, looking her in the eyes. For the trust I placed in you. A moment ago there was talk of love, and now we're starting to talk of trade. She was silent for a long while. Then she hit her boot violently hard with the riding crop.
Yennefer, she quickly recited. The one whose name you called me several times in the night, in moments of ecstasy, never betrayed you, nor Ciri. She was never an accomplice of Vilgefort's. In order to rescue Cirilla, she fearlessly took an exceptional risk. She suffered a defeat and fell into Vilgefort's hands. She was certainly tortured into the attempts at scanning that took place last autumn. It's not known if she's alive. I don't know anymore, I swear.
Thank you, Fringilla.
Now go.
I trust you, he said without moving, and I shall never forget what was between us. I trust you, Fringilla. I won't stay with you, but I think I loved you too, in my own way. Please keep utterly secret what you are about to find out. Vilgefort's hideout is in...
Wait!
She interrupted.
You'll tell me later. You'll disclose it later. Now, before you leave, say goodbye to me. The way you ought to say goodbye. Not with paltry letters, not with mumbled apologies. Say goodbye to me the way I desire.
She took off her lynx fur coat and tossed it down on a pile of straw. She violently tore off her blouse, beneath which she was naked. She fell onto the fur, pulling him after her, onto her. Geralt caught her by the nape of her neck, lifted up her skirt, and suddenly realized there'd be no time to take his gloves off. Fringilla was fortunately not wearing gloves, or knickers. Even more fortunately, she wasn't wearing spurs either, for soon after, the heels of her riding boots were literally everywhere. It doesn't bear thinking what might have happened had she been wearing spurs. When she screamed, he kissed her, stifling the scream. The horses, scenting their furious passion, neighed, stamped, and thumped against their stalls until hay and dust fell from the ceiling.
Rhys Run Citadel in Nazaire by Lake Muradach,
Fringilla Vigo ended triumphantly.
That's where Vilgefort's hideout is. I got it out of the Witcher before he rode away. We have enough time to overtake him. He has no chance of getting there before April.
The nine women gathered in the columns chamber of Montecalvo Castle nodded, favouring Fringilla with looks of great appreciation.
Rhys Run,
repeated Philippa Eilhart, baring her teeth in a predatory smile and playing with a sardonyx cameo brooch fastened to her dress.
Rhys Run in Nazaire. Well, see you soon, Master Vilgefortz. See you soon.
When the Witcher gets there, hissed Kira Metz, he'll find rubble, which by then would even be stinking of ash.
Or dead bodies, Sabina Glevesig smiled enchantingly.
Well done, Miss Vigo, nodded Scherler. Over 3 months in Toussaint. But it was probably worth it.
Fringilla Vigo's eyes swept over the sorceresses sitting at the table. Over Scherler, Philippa and Sabrina Glevesig. Over Kira Metz, Margarita Lozantila and Triss Merigold. Over Francesca Finderbear and Ida Emeyan, whose eyes, ringed with garish elven makeup, expressed absolutely nothing. Over Azira Var Anahid, whose eyes expressed anxiety and concern.
It was, she admitted,
quite sincerely. The sky slowly changed from dark blue to black. An icy gale blew among the vineyards. Geralt fastened his wolfskin cloak and wrapped a woolen scarf around his neck, and felt wonderful. As usual, love expressed had raised him up to the peak of his physical, psychological, and moral powers, had erased all traces of doubt, and his thinking was clear and intense. He only regretted he would be deprived of that wonderful panacea for a long time. The voice of Reynard de Boisfrin startled him out of his reverie.
"Bad weather's coming," said the knight-errant,
looking eastwards from where the gale was blowing.
"Make haste. If snow comes with that wind, if it catches you on the Malheur Pass, you'll be stuck in a trap. And then pray for a thaw to all the gods you venerate, know and understand."
"We understand."
"The Sandrator will guide you for the first few days. Keep to the river. You'll pass a trapper's manufactory and reach a place where a right bank tributary flows into the Sandrator. Don't forget, a right bank tributary. Its course will indicate the way to the Malheur Pass. Should you, with God's will, conquer Malheur, don't hurry too much, for you'll still have the Sans-Merci and the Mort Blanc passes ahead of you. Should you conquer both of them, you'll descend into the Sudduth Valley. Sudduth has a warm microclimate, almost like Toussaint. Were it not for the poor soil, they would plant vines there."
He broke off, embarrassed by the reproachful gazes.
"Indeed," he hemmed. "To the point. At the mouth of the Sudduth lies the small town of Caravista. My cousin, Guy de Boisfrin, lives there. Visit him and mention me. Should it turn out my cousin's died or gone insane, remember the direction of your journey is the Magdera Plain, the valley of the River Silt. Further on, Geralt, it's according to the maps you copied of the town cartographers. Since we're on the subject of cartography, I don't exactly understand why you asked me about some castles or other. Better forget about that, Reynard. Nothing like that took place. You heard nothing, saw nothing. Even if they torture you. Understand?"
"I do."
"A rider," warned Cahir, getting his unruly stallion under control. "A rider's galloping towards us from the palace."
"If there's only one," Angoulême grinned, stroking the battle-axe hanging from her saddle, "it's small beer."
The rider turned out to be Dandelion, riding like a bat out of hell. Astonishingly, the horse turned out to be Pegasus, the poet's gelding, which didn't like galloping and was not in the habit of doing so.
"Well," said the troubadour, panting as though he had been carrying the gelding and not the other way around. "Well, I made it. I was afraid I wouldn't catch you."
"Just don't say you're finally riding with us."
"No, Geralt."
Dandelion lowered his head.
"I'm not. I'm staying here in Toussaint with my little weasel. I mean with Anarietta. But I couldn't not say farewell to you, or wish you a safe journey."
"Thank the Duchess for everything. I'll make excuses as to why it's so sudden and without a farewell. Explain it somehow."
"You took a knightly vow, and that's that. Everyone in Toussaint, including the little weasel, will understand. And here, have it. Let it be my contribution."
"Dandelion."
Geralt took a heavy pouch from the poet. We aren't suffering from a shortage of money. It's not necessary.
Let it be my contribution, repeated the troubadour. Cash always comes in useful. And besides, it isn't mine. I took those ducats from the little weasel's private coffer. Why are you looking like that? Women don't need money. I mean, what for? They don't drink, they don't play dice, and they're bloody women themselves. Well, farewell. Be off, because I'll burst into tears. And when it's all over, you have to stop by Tucson on your way back and tell me everything. And I want to hug Ciri. Do you promise, Geralt?
I promise.
So farewell.
Wait.
Geralt wheeled his horse around and rode closer to Pegasus. He took a letter surreptitiously from his bosom.
Make sure this letter reaches Fringilla Vigo. No, Dykstra.
Are you serious, Geralt? And how do you propose I do it?
Find a way. I know you will. And now farewell. Give us a hug, you old fool.
Give us a hug, comrade. I'll be looking out for you.
They watched him ride away and saw him trotting towards Beauclair. The sky darkened.
Reynard?
The Witcher turned around in the saddle.
Ride with us.
No, Geralt, replied Reynard de Boisfrin a moment later. I'm errant, but not asinine.
There was unusual excitement in the great columned chamber of Monte Calvo Castle. The subtle chiaroscuro of candelabras that usually predominated there was replaced by the milky brightness of a huge magical screen. The image on the screen shimmered, flickered and vanished, intensifying the excitement and tension, and anxiety.
Ha! Said Philippa Eilhard, smiling predatorily. Pity I can't be there. A little action would do me good, and a little adrenaline.
Sheila de Tankerville looked at her sarcastically, but didn't say anything. Francesca Finderbear and Ida Emeen magically stabilized the image and enlarged it to fill the entire wall. They clearly saw black mountain peaks against a dark blue sky, stars reflecting in the surface of a lake, and the dark and angular shape of a castle.
I still can't be sure, said Shayla, if it wasn't a mistake to entrust the command of the strike force to Sabrina and young Metz. They broke Kira's ribs on Thanith. She may want to get revenge. And Sabrina? Why? She loves action and adrenaline a little too much. Right, Philippa, we've discussed that already.
Philippa cut her off, and her voice was as acidic as plum pickle.
We've established what there was to establish. No one will be killed without an absolute need. Sabrina and Kira's force will enter Rhysrun as quiet as mice, on tiptoe, hush, hush. They'll take Vilgefortz alive, without a single scratch, without a single bruise. We agreed on that. Although I still think we ought to make an example, so that those in the castle who survive the night will awake screaming to the end of their days when they dream of this night.
Revenge, said the sorceress from Covir, is the delight of mediocre, weak, and petty minds.
Perhaps, agreed Philippa, with an apparently indifferent smile, but that doesn't stop it being a delight.
Let's drop it,
Margarita Lozantila raised a goblet of sparkling wine.
I suggest we drink to the health of Madame Fringilla Vigo, thanks to whose efforts Vilgefortz's hideout was discovered. Solid, exemplary work indeed, Madame Fringilla.
Fringilla bowed, responding to the salutes. She noticed something like mockery in Philippa's black eyes and dislike in the azure gaze of Triss Merigold. She couldn't decipher the smiles of Francesca and Sheila.
They are beginning, said Azirava Anahid, pointing at the magical image.
They settled themselves more comfortably. Philippa dimmed the lights with a spell in order for them to see better. They saw swift black shapes peeling off from the rocks, as silent and agile as bats. Saw them flying low and then plummeting onto the battlements and machicolations of Rhysrun Castle.
I probably haven't had a broom between my legs for a century, murmured Philippa. I'll soon forget how to fly.
Shayla, staring at the screen, quietened her with an impatient hiss. Fire flashed briefly in the windows of the Black Castle complex. Once, twice, thrice. They knew what it was. The bolted doors and hasps splintered asunder under the impact of ball lightning.
"They're inside," said Asirava Anahid softly.
She was the only one not observing the screen on the wall, but was staring at a crystal ball on the table.
"The strike force is inside, but something's not right. Not how it's meant to be."
Fringilla felt the blood flowing from her heart to her belly. She now knew what wasn't right.
"Madame Glevisig," reported Azira, "is opening the direct telecommunicator."
The space between the columns and the hall suddenly lit up. In the materializing oval, they saw Sabrina Glevisig in male attire, her hair tied on her forehead with a chiffon scarf, and her face blackened with stripes of camouflage pigment. Behind the sorceress's back could be seen dirty stone walls, and on them, shreds of rags, once tapestries. Sabrina extended a gloved hand hung with long strands of cobwebs towards them.
"The only thing there's plenty of here," she said, gesticulating wildly, "is this. Just this. Bloody hell, what stupidity. What a fiasco."
"Make yourself clearer, Sabrina."
"Make what clearer?" yelled the Kaidwanian witch. "What could be clearer here? Can't you see? This is Rhys Run Castle. It's empty. Empty and dirty. It's a sodding empty ruin. There's nothing here. Nothing."
Kira Metz emerged from behind Sabrina's shoulder, looking like a hellish fiend in her facial camouflage.
"There isn't, and there hasn't been anyone in this castle," she said calmly, "for at least 50 years. For 50 years, there hasn't been a living soul here, not counting the spiders, rats and bats. We made the landing in completely the wrong place."
"Have you made sure it isn't an illusion?
Do you take us for children, Philippa?"
"Listen, both of you."
Philippa Eilhart nervously ran her fingers through her hair.
"Tell the mercenaries and novices they were on maneuvers. Pay them and return. Return at once. And put a brave face on it. Do you hear? Put a brave face on it."
The oval of the communicator went out. Only the image on the wall screen remained. Rhys Run Castle against the black sky, twinkling with stars, and the lake with the stars reflected in it. Fringilla Vigo looked down at the table. She felt as though the pounding blood would soon burst her cheeks.
Really,
she said at last, unable to bear the silence in the columned hall of Montecalvo Castle.
"I really don't understand."
"But I do,"
said Triss Merigold.
"That castle,"
said Philippa, deep in thought, not paying any attention to her comrades.
"That castle, Rhys Run, will have to be destroyed, utterly annihilated. And when legends and tales begin to be made up about this whole debacle, it will be necessary to subject them to scrupulous censorship. Do you understand what I mean, ladies?"
"Only too well,"
nodded Francesca Finderbear, who had been silent up until that moment. Ida Emeyan, also silent, took the liberty of making quite an ambiguous snort. Fringilla Vigo still seemed stunned.
"I truly can't comprehend how it could have happened."
"Oh,"
said Shayla de Tankerville, after a very long silence.
"It's nothing serious, Miss Vigo. No one's perfect."
Philippa snorted softly. Azirava Anahid sighed and raised her eyes towards the plafond.
"After all," added Shayla, pouting her lips, "it's befallen all of us at some time. Each of us sitting here has been cheated, taken advantage of, and made a laughing stock of by some man at some time."
"I love you. I'm charmed by your lovely form. And if you're not willing, I'll have to use force."
"Father, my father, he's gripped me at last. The Earl Koenig's hurting me, holding me fast."
Johann Wolfgang Goethe.
"Everything has been.
Everything has happened, and everything has already been written about.
Visigota of Corvo. Chapter 5. A scorching, stuffy afternoon fell on the forest, and the lake surface, which had been as dark as jade shortly before, now flashed gold and lit up with reflections. Ciri had to shield her eyes with her hand. The glare reflected in the water blinded her, and she felt pain in her eyeballs and temples. She rode through the lakeside thicket and urged Kelpie into the lake, deep enough for the water to reach above the mare's knees. The water was so clear that even from the height of the saddle, Ciri could see the colourful mosaic of the bottom, the mussels and the swaying feathery pondweed in the shadow cast by the horse. She saw a small crayfish striding proudly among the pebbles. Kelpie whinnied. Ciri jerked the reins and rode into the shallows, but not onto the bank, because it was sandy and covered in rocks, and that ruled out riding fast. She led the mare right to the water's edge, so she could walk on the hard gravel at the bottom, and almost at once urged Kelpie into a trot. She was as fleet as a real trotter, trained not to be ridden, but to pull a gig or a landau. But she soon found that trotting was too slow. A kick of Ciri's heels and a shout urged the mare into a gallop. They raced among splashes of water flying all around, sparkling in the sun like drops of molten silver. When she saw the tower, she didn't slow down, yet not even the merest snort was audible in Kelpie's breathing, and her gallop was still light and effortless. She hurtled into the courtyard at full speed, with a clatter of hooves, and pulled the mare up so suddenly that for a moment Kelpie's horseshoes slid over the flags with a long, drawn-out grinding sound. She stopped just before the elf women, waiting at the foot of the tower, right in front of their noses. She felt satisfaction, for two of them, usually unmoving and dispassionate, now stepped back involuntarily.
"Never fear," she snorted. "I won't ride you down, unless I mean to."
The elves recovered quickly. Their faces once more smoothed by calm and nonchalant indifference returned to their eyes. Ciri dismounted, or rather flew from the saddle. There was defiance in her eyes.
"Bravo," said a fair-haired elf with a triangular-shaped face, emerging from the shadow under an arcade. "A nice display, Lochlight."
He had greeted her like that the first time, when she had entered the Tower of the Swallow and found herself among the blooming spring. But that was long ago, and things like that had stopped making any impression on her at all.
"I'm no Lady of the Lake," she barked. "I'm a prisoner here, and you're my jailers, and I may as well speak bluntly. There you go."
She threw the reins to one of the elves.
"The horse needs rubbing down. Water her when she cools, and above all, she must be looked after."
The fair-haired elf smiled slightly.
"Indeed," he said, watching the elf women wordlessly lead the mare to the stable. "You're a wronged prisoner here, and they are your harsh jailers. It's quite plain.
Let them have a taste of their own medicine."
She stood akimbo, stuck up her nose and looked him boldly in the eyes, which were pale blue like aquamarines, and quite gentle.
"I'm treating them as they treat me, and a prison's a prison."
"You astonish me, Lochlight.
And you treat me like a fool, and you haven't even introduced yourself."
"I apologize. I am Crevan Isbane Ipcomhan Maha. I am, if you know what it means, Ian Severn."
"I do."
She looked at him with an admiration that she was unable to hide in time.
"A knowing one, an elven sorcerer."
"I could be called that. For convenience, I use the alias Avalach, and you may address me as such."
"Who told you," she became sullen, "that I wished to address you at all? Knowing one or not, you're a jailer, and I'm
a prisoner," he finished sarcastically.
"You mentioned it.
A badly treated prisoner to boot. You're probably forced to take rides around here. You wear a sword on your back as a punishment. Likewise, the elegant and quite rich apparel. so much more elegant and clean than what you arrived here in. But in spite of these dreadful conditions, you haven't given in. You get your revenge for the harm you've received with brusqueness. With great courage and enthusiasm, you also smash looking glasses, which are works of art. She blushed, very cross with herself. Oh, he said quickly, you may smash looking glasses to your heart's content. After all, they're only objects, and who cares if they were made 700 years ago? Would you like to promenade with me along the lake shore? The wind that rose slightly tempered the heat. Furthermore, the tall trees and the tower cast shadows. The water in the bay was a dull green, densely garlanded by water lilies, and piled up with spherical yellow flowers. It almost resembled a meadow. Moorhens, gargling and nodding their red beaks, cruised briskly among the leaves.
That mirror,
Ciri mumbled, twisting a heel in the wet gravel.
I'm sorry about that. I lost my temper, and that's that.
Ah.
They disrespect me, those elf women. When I talk to them, they pretend they can't understand. And when they do talk to me, they speak incomprehensibly on purpose. They humiliate me.
You speak our tongue fluently, he explained calmly. But it's still a foreign language to you. Besides, you use Henhlinge, and they use Elishlion. The differences are slight, but do nonetheless exist.
I understand you, every word.
When I talk to you, I use Henhlinge, the language of the elves from your world.
And you? She turned around. What world are you from? I'm not a child. It's enough to look up at night. There isn't a single constellation I know. This world isn't mine. It isn't my place. I entered it by accident. And I want to leave, to get away.
She bent over, picked up a stone, and made a movement as though meaning to throw it absent-mindedly into the lake, towards the moorhens. She abandoned her plans under his gaze.
Before I've ridden a furlong, she said,
not hiding her resentment,
I'm at the lake, and I can see the tower. Regardless of which direction I ride, when I turn around, there's always the lake and the tower. Always. There's no way of getting away from it. So it's a prison. Worse than a dungeon, than an oubliette, than a chamber with a barred window. Do you know why? Because it's more humiliating. Elishlon or not, it angers me when I'm sneered at and shown disrespect. Yes, yes, there's no sense making faces. You've also slighted me. You also mock me. And you're surprised that I'm furious.
As a matter of fact, I am. He opened his eyes wide. Inordinately. She sighed and shrugged.
I entered the tower long ago, she said, trying to stay calm. I happened upon another world. You were waiting for me, sitting and playing the pipes. You were even astonished at how long I delayed my arrival. You called me by my name, and only afterwards began that Lady of the Lake nonsense. Then you vanished without a word of explanation, leaving me in prison. Call it what you like. I call it spiteful and malicious contempt.
Ziriel, it's only been 8 days.
Ah, she scowled. You mean I'm lucky? Because it might have been 8 weeks, or 8 months, or eight...
She fell silent. You've strayed far from Lara Doren, he said softly. You've lost your inheritance. You've lost the bond with your blood. No wonder the women don't understand you, nor you them. You don't just talk differently. You think differently. Quite different frames of reference. What is 8 days or 8 weeks? Time means nothing.
Very well, she screamed in anger. I agree I'm not a wise elf. I'm a stupid human. To me, time does mean something. I count the days, I even count the hours. And I've reckoned that many of both the first and the second have passed. I don't want anything from you now. I'll make do without explanations. It doesn't bother me why it's spring here, why there are unicorns here and different constellations in the night sky. I'm not at all interested how you know my name and how you knew I'd turn up here. I only want one thing. To return home. To my world. To people. People who think like me. Using the same frames of reference.
You'll return to them. In some time.
I want to go now! She yelled. Not in some time. For time here is an eternity. What right do you have to hold me here? Why can't I leave this place? I came here myself, of my own will. You don't have any right.
You came here yourself, he calmly confirmed. But not of your own will. You were led here by destiny, helped a little by us, for you have been long awaited. Very long, even according to our reckoning.
I don't understand any of that.
We've waited long. He paid no attention to her, fearing but one thing, whether you'd be able to enter here. You were. You proved your blood, your lineage. And that means that your place is here, not among the Doin. You are the daughter of Lara Doran Ap Shaedal.
I am Pavetta's daughter. I don't even know who your Lara is.
He snorted, but very slightly, almost imperceptibly. In that case, he said, it'd be best if I explained to you who my Lara is. Since time is short, I'd prefer to begin the explanations en route. But why? For the sake of a foolish demonstration, you've almost run the mare into the ground.
Into the ground? Ha! You don't yet know how much that mare can endure. Where are we going?
If you permit, I'll also explain that en route.
Ciri halted Kelpie, who was now wheezing, recognizing that a breakneck gallop was senseless and of no use at all. Avalach hadn't lied. Here, on open ground, on meadows and moors dotted with menhirs, the same force was active as around Tor Zirael. You could try riding at full speed in any direction, but after a furlong or so, an invisible force made you ride around in a circle. Ciri patted the wheezing Kelpie on her neck and looked at the small group of elves who rode at an easy pace. A moment earlier, when Avalach had finally told her what they wanted from her, she had launched into a gallop to escape from them, to leave them as far as possible behind her, they and their impudent, unthinkable task. Now, though, they were in front of her again, at a distance of more or less a furlong. Avalach hadn't lied. There was no escape. The only good thing the gallop had brought was that it had cooled her head, chilled her rage. She was now much calmer, but nonetheless, she was still shaking with anger.
What a mess I'm in, she thought. Why did I go into the tower?
She shuddered, thinking back, recalling Bonhart riding after her across the ice on his grey horse, muzzle foaming. She shuddered even more intensely and calmed down.
I'm alive, she thought, looking around. It's not the end of the battle. Death will end the fight. Everything else only interrupts it. They taught me that at Caer Morhen.
She urged Kelpie to a walk, and then, seeing the mare was gamely raising her head, to a trot. She rode down an avenue of menhirs. The grass and heather reached her stirrups. She quite quickly caught up with Avalach and the three elf women. The sage, smiling slightly, turned his aquamarine eyes inquiringly on her.
Please, Avalach.
She cleared her throat.
Tell me it was a dismal joke.
Something like a shadow passed over his face.
I'm not accustomed to joking, he said. And since you consider it a joke, I'll take the liberty repeating it with due gravity. We want to have your child, O Swallow, daughter of Lara Doran. Only when you bear it will we permit you to leave here, to return to your world. The choice, naturally, is yours.
I presume your reckless dash helped you to reach a decision.
What is your answer?
My answer is no, she replied firmly. Categorically and absolutely no. I don't agree, and that's that.
Tough luck, he shrugged. I admit I am disappointed, but why? It's your choice.
How can you demand something like that at all? She cried in a trembling voice. How could you dare? By what right?
He looked at her calmly. Ciri also felt the gaze of the elf women on her.
I believe, he said, that I told you the story of your family in detail. You seemed to understand. Thus, your question astonishes me. We have the right to demand, and we can, O Swallow. Your father, Cregennan, took a child from us. You will give us one back. You will repay the debt. It seems just and logical to me.
My father! I don't remember my father, but he was called Dooney, not Cregennan. I've already told you.
And I replied that those few ridiculous human generations are meaningless to us.
But I don't want to,
yelled Ciri, so loudly that the mare skittered beneath her.
I don't want to, understand? I don't want to! The thought of a bloody parasite being implanted in me is sickening. I feel nauseous when I think that that parasite will grow inside me, that...
She broke off, seeing the faces of the elf women. Two of them expressed boundless astonishment. The third, boundless odium. Avalach coughed meaningfully.
Let's ride on a little and talk in private, he said coolly. Your views, O Swallow, are a little too radical to be expressed in front of witnesses.
She did as he asked. They rode on in silence for a long while.
I'll escape from you.
Ciri spoke first.
You won't keep me here against my will. I escaped from the Isle of Thanet. I escaped from the Trappers and the Nilfgaardians. I escaped from Bonhart and Tawny Owl. And I'll escape from you. I'll find a way to outwit your witchcraft.
I thought, he replied a moment later, that you cared more about your friends, about Yennefer and Geralt.
You know about that?
She gasped in amazement.
Well, yes, true. You are a knowing one, so you ought to know I'm thinking about them. There, in my world, they're in danger now, at this moment. And yet you want to imprison me here? Well, for at least 9 months. You see for yourself I don't have a choice. I understand it's important for you, a child, that elder blood. But I cannot. I simply cannot.
The elf said nothing for a while. He rode so close he was touching her knee.
The choice, as I said, belongs to you. You ought, however, to know something. It would be dishonest to conceal it from you. You can't escape from here, O Swallow. So if you refuse to cooperate, you will stay here forever and will never see your friends or your world again.
That's despicable blackmail.
If, though, he continued, unconcerned by her yelling, you agree to what we ask, we'll prove to you that time is meaningless.
I don't understand.
Time passes differently here than there. If you do us this favor, we shall return the favor. We shall enable you to regain the time you will lose among us here. Among the folk of the Elder.
She said nothing, her eyes fixed on Kelpie's black mane.
Use the lame tactics, she thought.
As Vesemir said in Kaer Morhen, when they're about to hang you, ask for a glass of water. You never know what might happen before they bring it.
One of the elf women suddenly screamed and whistled. Avalach's horse neighed and danced on the spot. The elf brought it under control and shouted something to the elf women. Ciri saw one of them draw a bow from a leather quiver hanging from her saddle. She stood up in the stirrups and shielded her eyes with a hand.
Keep calm, said Avalach sharply.
Ciri gasped. Some